Times. I'm Artie Moscoein. Gary Steingart was born in Leningrad in 1972, near the end of the Cold War, and he loved Vladimir Lenin. In fact, he wrote a story when he was little titled Lenin and His Magical Goose. When he learned that he and his parents were moving to the United States, all he could think was, we're going to live with the enemy. Steingart has become a popular and award-winning novelist with three satiric and highly entertaining books, The Russian Debutante's Handbook, Absurdistan, and Super Sad True Love Story. He's now written a memoir titled Little Failure, and in the acknowledgments noted, "And I thought writing novels was hard?" He describes his many struggles trying to get comfortable in his new country while dealing with his parents' intense and demanding love. The title of the book is a name his mother called him, Failurchka, when he failed to get into an Ivy League college. It's been many years, and Gary Steingart, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be back. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Failurchka.
Failurchka.
And this was harder to write to write than your novels, because it's about real things. It's about you. It's about your parents.
Right. Yeah. I mean, with satire, you can always sort of hide under the cover of humor. You know, if things get too touchy, you can just make a joke out of it. But here, it's a little harder because it's my life, the life of my parents, the life of other people around me. So, you know. Can't just keep scampering away and making jokes all the time.
And do you think your other books were that, a kind of a diversion,
There were some diversionary tactics, but I think you start out writing satire with the idea, okay, I may have a message, but my primary goal is to entertain the readers. Whereas, I'm not saying I don't want to entertain the readers with this book, but definitely I wanted to lead with the truth, which was difficult and sad and unfortunate and annoying and...
Well, I'm someone that reads, loves to read memoirs, I guess because I am a voyeur and I'm interested in other people. But I always wonder when people write memoirs whether there's a kind of chutzpah involved in that. Like, who would be interested in my life?
I know. Who cares, you know? And people have said, you know, you're only 41. How can you write a memoir now? But 41 is, you know, 67 in Russian years. So I'm almost at the end of the
road. Does it feel that way?
It feels like a very long life has been lived. I'm exhausted, you know. I can't wait to get some sleep.
And what was it like to go back and kind of maybe perhaps remember but also piece together your life?
Hard. I mean, the book ends with a trip to St. Petersburg, Russia, which was a very difficult trip because, and I don't want to give away too much, but all kinds of various family secrets were learned. But also, you know, if in my 20s there was a sort of undercurrent of rage toward my parents and my background, the ultimate product of this book is a kind of deep sympathy, because I realized just how awful and how difficult those lives have been, not just the lives of my parents, but the lives of the people that preceded them. My mother has a whole photo album that's devoted to a dead uncle and his family that was buried alive during the World War II. I mean, this is a different magnitude than you get in most family albums.
But something that helped you, what, understand your parents, humanize your parents, understand their difficult personalities, if I can say that.
You can, and I think, the you know, as much as it sounds like a cliche, but also love my parents, you know, in a different way. My father's first four memories, somebody came to his door and said, you know, your father has been killed in the war. He's 3 years old. Second memory, they're being evacuated from Leningrad. They have to jump under a train as the German bombers attack. Third memory, his best friend dies, possibly of starvation. His fourth memory is his aunt jumps out of a building as these rats pursue her because she's a small kid and they want to eat her. I mean, these are, you know, you think of that and you think, my God, they really did the best with what they had.
Yeah, and caught between Stalinism and Nazism.
Right. Hitler and Stalin are sort of the two main protagonists of the early part of this memoir, because they changed everything. You know, my grandfather died in the opening days of World War II. They were trying to break the siege of Leningrad. And my father inherited a horrific stepfather who treated him with all the cliches of bad stepfathers. And, you know, the sort of thesis, one of the theses of this book is that if my grandfather hadn't died, my life would have been entirely different, as my father would have grown up to be a different man, too.
Well, in fact, talking about his stepfather, as you write, the stepfather that in a sense destroyed your father's life, quote, and made me whatever I am today.
Whatever it is that I am today is thanks to him. Yeah, it was a step-grandfather. His best friends had a nickname for him, Goebbels, so you can only imagine what... He drank nicely, too. He was pretty good at that.
Yeah. You describe, I have to say, the Soviet Union that you describe growing up in feels almost medieval. You were a sickly child, right. And in order to, I guess, help you with your illnesses, they would put these what felt like sort of burning bottles on your back to try to draw the asthma or whatever from your lungs.
Yeah, I think this is something we adopted from the Chinese or maybe the Mongol Tatars, or I don't know where this came from, but it's called cupping. And you burn a match inside a glass vessel, and then you cup it to the child's back so that supposedly it'll suck out the mucus. I suffered from incredible asthma.
Right.
And when we got to Vienna, that was the first step in immigrating from Russia to the U.S. And a doctor looked at my back, which looked like it had been beaten to shreds because of this cupping, you know, and he said, "My God, you medieval people." And he just gave me an asthma steroid inhaler, and all of a sudden I started breathing. So that was really, I mean, talk about a metaphor in moving from the east to the west. I can breathe. That's one of the first things that happened upon leaving Soviet soil.
Well, and I can't imagine anything scarier, especially as a little kid, about either not being able to breathe or losing one's breath or being afraid of that.
Right. And one of my first memories is of my father staying up all night and putting a finger inside my mouth or holding it open with a spoon to make sure that I would not choke to death during the night. So good stuff for a writer, though, to be exposed to mortality so early on.
Well, in fact, you say there's a strange beauty of being sickly.
The strange beauty is that you're lying in bed all the time. You're surrounded. I guess now you're just looking at your iPod as a kid, iPad. But back then, you actually read books after books after books, and I'd consumed books by the bushel back then and started to write my own little novel, you know, Lenin and His Magical Goose, for which my grandmother paid me a little slice of cheese for every page I wrote, and I love cheese. And so I wrote 100 pages for 100 pieces of cheese, and even today Random House pays me in cheese. So the tradition continues, you know.
And as you describe this book that you wrote as a little boy, that it was about loving authority but trusting no one.
Well, that's sort of the Soviet paradox is, you know, you have to follow authority blindly, and on some level you also know that it's just nonsense, and you know, you're following authority and you're telling Brezhnev jokes under your breath. But boy, did I want to believe in something, you know.
Yes.
And in Soviet Union it was social, it was communism, it was Lenin, it was the Red Army, and then when we got to Rome, right between the switch from the USSR to the U.S., my father said, "Everything you were taught was a lie." And so we went from worshiping Lenin to worshiping Reagan in the space of a year, which is, I think, a Guinness World Record.
A lot of immigrants come to this country. Their names either are changed by somebody else or they change their names. Your first name changed to Gary.
Yes, it was Igor, which is a beautiful Russian name. Igor, it's pronounced in Russian. I love that name. And when I do book signings, many Igors come up and say, "Hey, I stuck to my Igorness. You know, I'm proud to be an Igor." And sadly, we thought, well, you know, I had enough problems in Hebrew school, so we thought, let's just change the letters around. We came up with Gory. Well, that's not so great either.
No.
But Gary Cooper. Hey,
was Gary Cooper?
Gary Cooper was in the back of our minds too. Yes, everyone loves Gary Cooper.
Indeed, but even in the Soviet Union, your last name was actually Steinhorn. It wasn't Steingart.
Yeah, somewhere it got mixed up too, and the real name was Igor Steinhorn, which means Igor Stonehorn, which possibly is the name of some Bavarian porn star or something.
But. Well, I'd love to have you read a section from the beginning of your memoir.
Sure. This is "Just As I'm Born in Leningrad at the Auto Birthing House." "I am born hungry, ravenous. I want to eat the world, and I can never be satiated. Breast, condensed milk, whatever you have, I will suck on it, bite it, swallow it. Years later, under the tutelage of my beloved grandma Polya, I will become a fatso. But for now, thin and lean and hungry is how I'll go. My mother is 26, and by the standards of the time, she is old to be a mother. My father is 33 and already halfway into his existence as far as the local life expectancy for men is concerned. My mother teaches piano at a kindergarten. My father is a mechanical engineer. They own an apartment of about 500 square feet with a balcony in the center of Leningrad, which makes them privileged in relative terms, far more privileged than we will ever be in the United States, even when a minor colonial in Little Neck, Queens, is added to our portfolio in the late 1980s. What is also true, and what will take me most of my life to understand, is that my parents are too dissimilar to marry successfully. The Soviet Union is supposed to be a classless society, but my father is a village boy from a difficult stock, and my mother is from the Petersburg cultural class, a class that has its own problems, but whose miseries are laughably minor by comparison. To my mother, my father's kin are savage and provincial. To my father, hers are pretentious and false. Neither of them is entirely wrong.
That's Gary Steingart, a reading from near the beginning of his memoir called Little Failure. And your book, in many ways, is about your father, but it's also about your parents' relationship, your relationship with each of them.
Yes.
I mean, I think at some point in everybody's life, hopefully you get to a point where you begin to look at your parents and try to understand how they became who they are and the kind of effect that they have on us or have on you.
It's very important to do so, obviously. I mean, and the whole enterprise of psychiatry is, other than popping pills all day long, is geared toward this kind of understanding, because obviously this is the model for all relationships you'll ever have. I mean, the book is – the first sort of half of the book is entirely concerned with my relationship with my parents, and then I go off into the world and start to have relationships with women, which in
don't
some
work way, out so well.
Don't work out so well. One woman is sent to prison after bashing in the head of the next boyfriend after me with a hammer in Florida. So,
your choice in women, a little sketchy, a little questionable.
Yeah, a little adventurous, I should say, you know, bring your own hammer kind of stuff. Yeah.
Your father hits you as a kid growing up, and I mean, in many ways, that's abuse. Do you feel like he abused you?
Well, I mean, in America, the word abuse is used, of course, and correctly so, about and also verbal abuse and other things. But in the culture we came from, hitting a child for not performing well, I think, is par for the course. I mean, how else will the child learn to do better? And I don't just speak of Russian culture here, but of many other cultures. I ended up at Stuyvesant High School, which is this sort of specialized math and science high school in New York, a holding pen for multinational nerds where everyone's from, you know, China, India, Russia, Korea. And, you know, God knows how many smacks it took for all of us to get into that school and then to go on to, you know, the University of Pennsylvania, wherever it is that people end up after Stuyvesant and then med school and so on. So I'm not condoning it or saying, hey, smack your kid, but that definitely is the background in which I grew up.
But you're a dad now. You're a father.
Yes.
You have a young son.
Yes.
I mean, all parents have to think about things like this.
Well, I know I will never, ever hit my kid, obviously, but I have, obviously, a different – I went to Oberlin College, not, you know, Leningrad Mechanical Technical Institute or whatever it was. So
they took some of that out of you?
Oberlin definitely smokes it out of you, so to speak, yes.
Have your parents – I know you have sent them a copy of this book. If they had read it, would they tell you they had read your book that they figure so prominently in?
I think they would, but also there's a question of language, which is that this might be a little too difficult for them. Their English is good, you know, conversationally, but I think one of the sacrifices they made was actually that around the dinner table we only spoke Russian, which allowed me to retain my Russian, but having a kid in the house usually helps the parents learn English, and that's not what happens. So usually I wait for the Russian translation for them to get really upset about what I've written. So still a ways off.
Yeah. I want to pick up on that. Gary Steingart, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's been a guest on the show talking about three novels that he has written. One, The Russian Debutante's Handbook, Absurdistan, and Super Sad True Love Story. He's written a memoir. It's called Little Failure, talking about growing up and being born in Leningrad, growing up in the Soviet Union, coming to the United States in 1979. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
The Meadowbrook School, located in Abington Township, supports WHYY and is an independent, small-by-design elementary school for children in grades preschool through 6th. Education at Meadowbrook emphasizes a lifelong love of learning, encourages both creative and critical thinking, expands a sense of integrity, and inspires students to make a positive difference. To learn more, there is a Meadowbrook Open House on Sunday, January 26th from 1 to 3 p.m. Registration at themeadowbrookschool.org.
Next time in Studio 360.
All right.
Matthew McConaughey's performance in Dallas Buyers Club is at times reminiscent of his big break in Dazed and Confused. So, does he make the connection?
No, and I don't think there is one.
I'll argue the case next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, the United States needs air power, but doesn't need an air force.
I think that the creation of the Air Force erected unnecessary bureaucratic barriers between the missions that the military most often does.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with writer Gary Steingart about his memoir called Little Failure. And he has written three other books, all novels. He's also a contributing editor to Travel and Leisure magazine. I want to read something that you write, one about your mother. My mother has it all wrong when it comes to love. She barely hits. She is the expert on the silent treatment. And then you write, when you hit the child, you're making contact. You're contacting the child's skin, his tender flanks, his head, but you're also saying something comforting. I'm here. I underlined that. I circled that. I struggled with that because, of course, the silent treatment can be very painful. I understand that. But the idea of hitting as a way of saying to someone, I am here. You're here.
Well, I'm being a little sarcastic, too. I mean, it's not fun to be hit, but what I'm saying is that the silent treatment in some ways was much worse because, remember, there was three of us. We came from Russia. We didn't speak English. I had no friends till God knows how old I was, you know. I was this hated freak in Hebrew school because of the, you know, this was the 1980s, the Ronald Reagan's Evil Empire speech, the Red Dawn, Red Gerbil, Red Hamster, all those movies, you know, it was a disaster. So the three of us were such a tight family unit that if my mother's not speaking to me, I would cry out in Russian, I would scream, it is better not to live. And my mother always made fun of that. And she said, oh, it's better not to live. But that's really what I meant. You know, I couldn't imagine a life where my mother wouldn't speak to me because we were all, there were just so few of us, you know.
And why would she give you the silent treatment?
Oh, for anything, you know, not eating enough farmer's cheese or ignoring one of her orders. And she was very much into a very specific regimented kind of life. Everything had to run in a certain way. So
you also describe an incident, and your father says to you, after this incident, I am never going to hit you again. And I got the sense reading it that you almost felt abandoned by him.
Yeah. You know, this kind of behavior, although obviously we frown upon it, but it's familiar. It creates this pattern where that's what you expect, you know. And so if you're not hitting me, does that mean that you're saying I'm not worthy of your attention? You know, am I just now so far gone that I'm not worthy of discipline? So that was, in a weird way, that really hurt when he said that I, you know.
Well, and it's clear. I mean, what makes this so interesting is it's so clear that your parents love you.
Yes.
And that you love them.
Yes.
And like, I guess, all love relationships between parents and children, it's so complicated and so fraught. And I think with immigrant children, everything is magnified because they're coming to a new country. Mm-hmm. And in your case, coming in many ways hoping that you won't be a sickly child anymore.
Sure, sure. I mean, my mother made the ultimate sacrifice in leaving her own dying mother behind in Leningrad. She knew that she was a kind of Sophie's Choice thing where either she stays with her mother and tends to her, or she makes sure that I survive, don't get drafted into the Red Army, get my share of asthma inhalers and all that stuff. So she made this incredible decision to move here, you know, which obviously impacted my life, saved my life, you could say. These are very difficult relationships. These aren't, these are as difficult a relationship as you can have, and they're the template for all other relationships. So,
but as I said, I think with immigrant children, parents coming with these high expectations can turn into high demands on a child.
Right. I mean, when I entered Stuyvesant High School, I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to be, you know, the best student ever. Harvard, Yale, and Princeton await. And in the end, it was, you know, Bucknell, Lehigh, Lafayette. I was just sort of,
these are Pennsylvania
colleges. I know they're Pennsylvania colleges, but this is exactly where, you know, for an immigrant family to not think about the Ivy League, it was a huge slap in my parents, I think, just crushing. We brought you here, and for what, you know? And in the end, I ended up at Oberlin College, which is a cute little school, very nice Marxist-Leninist school, but you know, which I enjoyed a lot. But it was a kind of it wasn't what was expected of me. And the term "little failure" actually happened after I graduated, and I promised my parents, look, you're going to spend $100,000 on this, you know, for me to major in the Beatles or whatever, but I will go to law school, I swear. And then I said, well, I'm going to want to be a writer. And my mother came and saw my roach-infested apartment and said, you're a little failure is what you are.
You did go to Solomon Schechter School, as you said, the second most hated by the Hebrew in the Hebrew school. And I was wondering, so who was the first most hated?
This guy who, in the book, I call Jerry Himmelstein, not his real name, but this guy was. It was amazing that there was somebody who was native born who was way more messed up than I was. I really thank you for being alive, Jerry Himmelstein. Otherwise, I would have been the most hated kid in Hebrew school.
And Mike, were you that obnoxious?
It wasn't that I was obnoxious, it's that I couldn't – well, maybe I was obnoxious, but I couldn't speak English real good. You know what I mean? The accent was thick. I was wearing a giant fur hat and fur coat, which we brought from Leningrad and was made out of some woodland animal. And the teachers took me aside and said, you know, kids will play with you more if you're furless maybe. You know? It's true for adulthood as well, you know.
But you also didn't have a TV, which I guess – put you kind of on the outs,
right?
Except when you went to your grandmother's.
So we weren't allowed to have a TV, and so because of that, I was stuck with a lady with lapdog all day long reading Chekhov instead of watching, you know, Buck Rogers. But my grandmother had a TV, but it was such an old TV. It could have been the first TV ever made that it could either catch the picture or the sound. So I would have to watch each episode twice to write down what happened and then try to match it with the dialogue. But, you know, then I started catching on to American culture, but it was so confusing. I loved Gilligan's Island, but I kept thinking, a country this powerful like America, their navy can't find the millionaire and his wife. These are important people. I mean, honestly.
Being much too logical.
Much too logical, yeah,
Well, I'd love to have you read actually another – I'm passing this book across the gigantic table here to you.
Okay.
Another section from your memoir.
Okay. 1979, coming to America after a childhood spent in the Soviet Union is equivalent to stumbling off a monochromatic cliff and landing in a pool of pure technicolor. I am pressing my nose to the windows of the taxiing jetliner, watching the first hints of my new homeland passing by. Oh, that immense solidity, the sweep of what used to be JFK's Pan Am terminal with its flying saucer roof, and above the expanse of sky that doesn't press down on Queens as the Russian sky tramples Leningrad, but flows past in waves, allotting a bit of itself to each red-bricked or aluminum-sided house and to each of the lucky families that dwells within. The airliners in their bright liveries are clustering around a sea of gates like hungry immigrants trying to get in. Sabina, Lufthansa, Aer Lingus, Avianca. The intensity of arrival will not abate. Everything is revelation. On the ride from the airport, I am shocked by my first highway overpass, the way a car, a private car bigger than three Soviet Ladas, leans into the curve hundreds of feet above the greenery of Queens. Here we are floating through the air, but in a car, and buckled into the back seat with my parents also leaning into the airborne curve. I feel the same emotions I will experience when choking upon my first cheesy American pizza slice months later. Elation, visceral excitement, but also fear. How will I ever measure up to the gentle, smiling giants strolling this land who launch their cars like cosmonauts into the infinite American sky and who live like lords in their little castles on 40 by 100 foot lots in Kew Gardens, Queens? How will I ever learn to speak English the way they do, in a way so informal and direct, but with the words circling the air like homing pigeons?
I love that section. And again, that's Gary Steingart, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And that's from his new book. It's a memoir titled Little Fish. Failure. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We actually have an email from Marge wondering if you were influenced in your memoir by Nabokov's beautiful Speak Memory.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful, beautiful book. Yeah, this is more like a shush memory or quiet down memory. Nabokov is the master wordsmith of the 20th century, I would say. Nobody can spin a sentence like him or a paragraph like him, so I can only bow my hat to him. That is an intense memoir, also about leaving Russia in very different circumstances. Mm-hmm. Nabokov, of course, grew up in one of the wealthiest families in Russia, if not the wealthiest at some point, and they lost everything. But to him, it wasn't even the money that was so important. It was the loss of language and culture. Now, for me, I came as a 7-year-old, not as a, I believe he was about 18 when he left. But still, the Russian language and culture are so immense and are so attractive that I did feel their loss as well. And as I said before, the fact that my parents continued to speak it was very important. Because when I write, there is a kind of bilingual stuff going on where there's another soundtrack that's being laid down that's actually Russian as I'm writing in English.
Is that true? And while we're talking, is that also happening?
Or No. Right now, I'm concentrating real hard on the English language because it's a beauty, too. A lot of words.
But do you feel obviously, you sound very comfortable with the English language. Is it totally fluid for you now?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in fact, Russian is now spoken with an American accent, and there are some lapses in vocabulary and So, yeah, I do. I mean, English is the dominant language, of course.
What I love about that reading is just going from the kind of what feels like the sort of black and white world of the Soviet Union to this technicolor country. I mean, it really did look that way.
It did look that way. And it just, I mean, the intensity of everything. You saw a Chevrolet Corvette on the street. And you wondered if it was an airplane with its wings folded in, or if it was a car. There was just nothing like it in the Soviet Union. There was nothing like anything. I mean, that's sort of the thing, is that, you know, today somebody can come from Mumbai or Shanghai, and if they're in the middle class, they're familiar with, you know, the iPad and Google and all this other stuff. But we had no familiarity with anything. The only thing my parents had growing up were some ABBA records from Sweden that were somehow allowed in. And so, you know, my mother singing money, 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 not so funny, you know, rich man's world. That's sort of what I grew up with as the only introduction to American culture.
And loving Lennon on top of that, right?
Loving Lennon on top of ABBA was it. I need a refund. Yeah.
And did they come? I mean, I know they came in part because there was this thaw, perhaps a temporary thaw between the Soviet Union and the U.S.
Well, there were a couple of things the Soviet Jews had wanted to get at for a very long time. American Jews were very kind in agitating for us, making sure that we were at the top of the political agenda. But really what it took was a horrible grain harvest in the Soviet Union, so that Brezhnev and Jimmy Carter came to a kind of deal where you know, hundreds of thousands of Soviet Jews were exchanged for millions of tons of American grain. So I was sort of exchanged for, you know, 300 pieces of bread and a croissant or something. That was my worth. I don't know who got the better deal out of it, but that's how it worked.
And your parents, do you think they were equally just overwhelmed by the lushness, perhaps the color, the technology of the United States? Did they see it like you did as a seven-year-old?
Well, I know that my mother, on her part, that she was at first, you know, we didn't land in a beautiful, what's your neighborhood called, Rittenhouse Square?
Yeah,
we lovely. Didn't, we didn't land in lovely Rittenhouse Square. We landed in Queens, and not a pretty part of Queens either. So my mother, I think, was very shocked by the non-Europeanness. I mean, St. Petersburg is a gorgeous city, and after that we went to Vienna, and then we went to Rome, and then we went to Queens. So as beautiful, I mean, as amazing as the technology was, I think on her part at least, she was a little hesitant at first by the lack of physical beauty. My father fell in love with it immediately, and I was, of course, just shocked by everything that it offered.
Your dad wrote, I mean, he wrote stories, he told stories. That seemed to be so much of your growing up.
Yes, he told stories called Planet of the Yids.
Yes, Planet of the Yids,
which he would take me around. And this is sort of how I began storytelling for, you know, I began to, when I was 11, I began to write little science fiction novels in my Hebrew school. So the Planet of the Yids was a planet deep in the Horsehead Nebula, I believe, that was surrounded by angry Slavic other planets that kept launching pork torpedoes at the hapless Jewish planets, the Planet of the Yids. And the Jews, the captain that was protecting them was called Captain Natan Sharansky, who was also the main dissident. So Captain Sharansky kept building space shields with which to deflect these large torpedoes that were constantly flying toward the Jews. Yeah. And it was hilarious, you know, and he would walk me around and tell me these stories over and over. And I would keep saying, Dad, tell me Planet of the Yids again, you know.
And you wrote your own Ganora, as you called it.
So my attempt at satire in Hebrew school was, and remember, you know, second most hated kid in Hebrew school, I thought, you know, how do I get these kids to like me? So we all had to study a lot of Torah and Talmud, and, you know, when you're 11, 12 years old, it kind of doesn't really register that well, all this Talmudic stuff. So I wrote my own version of the Torah called the Ganora, you know, in which Exodus became Sexodus and stuff like that. And Brooke Shields, I think, became part of our founding myth. You know, she was Jewish. Brooke Shieldowitz was, you know, part of the Jewish nation.
And did this erase your status at Solomon Schechter School?
I went from red gerbil to slightly tolerated fruitcake, you know, and that was a huge step up.
So were you unhappy while you were sort of finding your way?
You know, I was unhappy a lot of time, but storytelling, my father telling me those stories, or me sitting down at my IBM S-Electric that my mother had liberated from her place of work and just writing and writing and writing, those were the happy, happy, happy times.
You also write, and I thought this was an interesting commentary, which is a kind of racism, if I can say, looking down on black people. I mean, you were, in many ways, probably shared some of the same struggles, but the fact that you were white and educated put you in a different status.
Well, this does often happen with immigrant groups, is you land somewhere, you feel completely insecure, and you start to think, well, who is worse off, and how can I better merge with the main population in despising someone else? And remember, this is Ronald Reagan's era of the welfare queens, and you're constantly being told, and Russians were very conservative. You know, they came from a communist country, and the first thing that they thought of was, you know, well, who's the most anti-Soviet we can find, and that was obviously the Republican Party. And so, I mean, this happens, I think, in other communities as well that come from communist countries. So it was, that's what it was, and it was, it took me a long time to, I mean, the way I changed was that I left the parochial nature of Eastern Queens and ended up in high school in Manhattan, where everybody was from a different race or creed, and that's when I thought, oh my God, you know, these kids are actually smarter than I am, and here I am taught to look down on them. It doesn't make any sense.
Were you directly taught to look down on them, or just, it just sort of was in the air?
It's in the air. I mean, look, you know, there was a relative at a recent Thanksgiving who said in her Russian accent, I think Obama should be president, but of African country. This is white country, you know. And so...
That's not so long ago.
No, it doesn't really change. And you know, and the Fox News is on all day long, and the Russian equivalent of it, which is far worse, I think, so far more strident and right-wing. So it's really something.
But you write that your racism, as you called it, quote, died a smelly death.
It did. I mean, look, I don't know to what extent things die completely ever, and I mean, when subconsciously, who knows what goes on, but at least on an intellectual and emotional level, I couldn't look at another person and think anyone was inferior because they didn't look like me or look like something else.
And you, I don't know what your politics are now, but you certainly were, as you said, your family were conservative, Republicans,
yes.
Liked Ronald Reagan, I guess.
Yes. No, I'm center-left, and, you know, I think I'm fairly moderate, but, you know, to my parents, I'm the little liberal, as they would say.
Well, and your father called you little son.
Little son.
Little son.
Which is sweet. You know?
It is sweet.
Yeah, yeah.
But he also talked about, I mean, he also, I can't decide whether to use the present or past tense, but also seemed jealous of you.
He wanted to be an opera singer, and I think he had a very nice voice, but there were many things, including him being Jewish, that didn't exactly help him out in the Soviet Union and his quest. So that dream went unfulfilled. He became a mechanical engineer like so many other Soviet Jewish men. I think, you know, he's proud, very proud that I was able to succeed artistically, but I'm sure some part of him is also.
Yeah. He says, I burn with black envy toward you.
Which is such a beautiful phrase.
It is a beautiful phrase.
I mean, the other thing is that without the sort of almost Shakespearean quality of my parents' pronouncements, I would have never been able to write this book, because the way they speak, and I'm translating it from Russian, is absolutely amazing. I mean, even things like little failures is spectacular.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just when I was young, those words really hurt me, but now I just see them as these incredible material that I can process and use. You know?
But on the one hand, it's obviously so focused on you and so caring about what happens
it's
to you.
Very,
and
very
on the other hand, whether jealous or conflicted over the success that you might be enjoying, that they didn't have as young people.
Right. And this is what I mean when I talk about how the sort of the rage that I had in my 20s and earlier began turned into sorrow. I almost wished, my God, I wish my father had grown up in a normal country. I wish he had pursued his dream of becoming an opera singer and succeeded. I wish all of them had had the kinds of lives they really wished for themselves. You know, I'm really sorry that hadn't happened.
Yeah. And were they, we're almost up on a break here, but almost too old by the time they came to the U.S. to try to fulfill those dreams?
Well, of course. And also, I mean, it was amazing that they even found jobs other than driving a taxi, you know, that my father was able to do that. So,
that's Gary Steingart, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's a memoir titled Little Failure. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Resident Ensemble Players, Delaware's only resident professional acting company, supports WHYY and presents Agatha Christie's popular whodunit, The Mousetrap, January 23rd through February 9th. Two proprietors of a snowbound manor house, five shifty guests, one police detective, and a rising body count add up to one of the longest-running thrillers of all time. It's murder, pure and simple, and fiendishly fun. For tickets, 302-831-2204 or DelawareRep.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Joaquin Phoenix. He stars in the new film Her, which is nominated for an Oscar for Best Picture. We'll talk about his movies, his life, and his public image, like as an actor who hates to be interviewed.
I will make you another promise. Okay. I promise never to ever make you go through this again.
Actually, he's totally enjoyable in this interview. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
First, he transformed how the world uses computers. Then he and his wife, Melinda, changed the way the world views philanthropy.
Bill and I have been going to Tanzania for over a decade now. And when you talk to farmers who are seeing 3 times the yield on their farm, life for them is getting better.
Bill and Melinda Gates, next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. If you just joined us, Gary Steingart is our guest. He was born in Russia in 1972. His parents decided to take advantage of a thaw in the Cold War to come to the United States in 1979. And like many immigrant parents, they had high hopes and even higher expectations for their only child. His fourth book is a memoir titled Little Failure, written with his trademark wit and insight. It explores the intense and often difficult relationship with his father and includes an unsparing portrait of himself as a young man. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. We do have an email comment. Could he address the culture shock he faced as a European coming to the United States, especially in 1979?
Right. Well, the culture shock wasn't so much in being a European. I think, you know, if a Belgian had landed at JFK in 79, sure, he would have looked around and said, you know, well, could use some more chocolates and fries, but otherwise a lot of what I know. It was the fact that we had absolutely no orientation for – you know, 13 channels on TV, now a lot more, for, you know, thousands of radio stations, for choice. Choice was the really big thing that we never had. I mean, it wasn't just consumer products, but the idea that the government could treat you more or less like a human being instead of just a pawn in its own ideological schemes. Humanity is something that we never had. You know, this is, I go back to Russia all the time, and people say, well, how can Putin come back and impose this authoritarian system? It was always like that. You know, there's a restaurant in St. Petersburg called 1913, and I once asked the owner, why 1913? And she said, well, it was the only good democratic year in Russian history.
Wow. You know?
And so just, and as imperfect as America is, there was still this incredible feeling that, my God, one could be alive and count for something.
Well, what's interesting is there's such this sort of mix of humor, obviously, rage, if I dare say that's a very strong word, depression. I mean, all of that sort of, especially in your father, kind of roiling inside of him.
It was a childhood that you wouldn't wish upon anyone, you know. And after his father was killed as a young age, he would crawl under his the kitchen table and he would cry and he would sing opera. Even as a young kid, he realized he loved classical music and opera, and he would dream of going back in time and killing Hitler somehow so that his own father could be spared. I mean, that's laid down as one of your tracks, and the other track is you have this horrifying stepfather who's violent himself, you know. It doesn't. You don't quite grow out of that, and you know, you process it in different ways. But it will always be with you.
We learn later in the book that he'd spent time as a young adult in a mental institution.
That's
he
right.
was hospitalized.
He was hospitalized, and it's, you know, being that Soviet healthcare and mental care, especially, is the way it is. It's impossible to know what happened. He had some kind of attack where he, you know, passed out, and they brought him to this hospital, and there were people, you know, smearing their excrement on the walls next to him. It was an absolutely horrific place, right. And they had no treatment. They didn't know what it was, so they just treated him with, you know, they injected air into his spine. I mean, they did horrifying things that you wouldn't, you know, do to a political prisoner in Syria, you know, and that's what he suffered. And in the end, that only, I think, contributed to his right. depression, obviously, and it didn't alleviate it. So we're talking about a very, very difficult life.
Well, and he at one point sort of tells you that one of the reasons he was there was some kind of feelings that he might have towards men. I mean, it doesn't expand on that.
No, I don't think he had feelings toward men, but I think they tried to. One of the things they did was they thought that erections were the cause of all evil, and so they tried to suppress them by giving them tons of bromide and stuff like this, which, of course, had no good effect whatsoever.
I misread this. They made me drink buckets of valerian root bromide so that I wouldn't have any male desires.
Oh, male desires meaning physical desires,
yeah,
in general, erections and things like that, not desires toward men.
I got you. I got you.
But I just want to clarify that.
But what a revelation, right?
Yeah, what a revelation. What a revelation.
And do you think, was it helpful for him to sort of tell you this, to share some of...
Well, it wasn't stuff that I elicited. You know, we were walking down the street in St. Petersburg, and he said, look, son, something very terrible happened to me on the street, and we were walking past this mental hospital. And I wasn't expecting that. And
yeah.
Then he told me and just knocked my breath out. I just thought, my God, I'm learning so much, and so much of it is so sad.
Yeah. And... But what I get, the feeling I get from the way you write is that you now understand your parents. I mean, maybe that's...
Yes. I mean, one can never fully understand anyone, but
right.
I certainly understand them a lot more. You know, I think if one of the goals of life is to understand one's parents and where one is from, I think when we do, you know, so many Americans are obsessed with genealogy and figuring out where they come from. But the real challenge is the challenge next door, not figuring out seven generations ago, but figuring out what took place in your own lifetime. And so I feel like I've done as much as I can in this book right now for being 41 years old to figure out where we are and how we got there.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you're pretty tough on yourself.
Yes,
in
very
this
much
book.
So.
And I don't know what it would have been like to know you in your 20s or early 30s. Not too much fun. But you had a friend who wrote you a letter. John, you call him John in the book, who wrote you this letter.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just read a couple of sentences. Do you want to spend your life as a frightened, angry person, taking your deepest fears and problems out on innocent bystanders as well as on yourself? In 5 or 10 years, you could be a father bestowing upon his children the same kind of misery that you now enjoy. That's how it works. Your inability to empathize makes it difficult for you to put yourself in the skin of the characters you write. And he goes on from there.
Mm-hmm.
You include this in your book.
I do, yes. It was an amazing letter that was written in my 20s. John was an amazing friend, older than I, kind of a mentor, and he worked a lot on, I was writing my first book, The Russian Debutante's Handbook, and
yeah.
He had been a writer for many soap operas, and the two are different, but he had a great sense of language, and so he really helped me with this book. But at the same time, he could see that I was falling apart. I was dating a woman who would end up in prison very soon. I was
drinking
nonstop and other things. And so, you know, he really put down the law, and he said, you know, if our relationship is to continue, mine and his, you have to enter psychotherapy.
Yeah.
Which I did, and which was very, very positive.
In fact, about 12 years, or I don't know if you're still in psychotherapy.
I'm still in there. We're almost done, and I think this memoir is a way to finish it. But unlike most New Yorkers, I only go 4 times a week, not 5. So I'm a bit of a laggard when it comes to full Woody Allen-esque psychoanalysis.
Well, it's fun to make fun of psychoanalysis psychotherapy, but when it works, it's a revelation.
It's a revelation. And so much of this memoir was, in a sense, published while lying on the couch and just saying these things aloud and then sort of seeing them float in front of me and realizing what was true.
Right. John says in this letter, you have to decide to take yourself seriously, not in a phony, self-pitying way, but in a serious, dignified way.
Right. Those are beautiful words.
They really are.
Words to live by.
I mean, you know, how many people get a letter like that?
A lot of luck I had in meeting someone like John, you know. Very rare, but those are the steps that led to being able to write, really. I mean, I always wrote. He didn't instill that in me, but being able to, because writing is discipline in a big way. You know, to write any number of books requires being able to deal with everyday life without constantly falling apart, which so many creative people do. I mean, that part of our lives, part of being creative is having a childhood that's interesting, to say the least. And then the next step is, how do you keep it all together?
Your book is dedicated to your parents, but also to your psychotherapist.
Right. Two very important forces in my life.
Yeah.
Two very good forces in my life.
Help us. What is your relationship with your psychotherapist? I mean, how do you see him?
Well, I don't see him. You know, it's traditional psychoanalysis.
Well, you're not looking at him.
I'm not
right?
even looking at him. I have a vague idea that he has a beard and, you know, white hair, but beyond that, I don't know.
Looks a little bit like Sigmund Freud, perhaps.
He's very Freudian looking. Yeah, there's a picture of Freud next to him, and it's a very close comparison between them.
Is there a reason you picked psychoanalysis, which is, you know, pretty intensive?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, look, nobody really, very few people do psychoanalysis anymore, because who has the time, who has the money? And I was lucky that I got a nice break. He was very kind to me in the beginning to give a very sliding scale where I paid almost nothing for many years. Mm-hmm. But it's very difficult to find, especially the time in the world we live in, you know. But I figured, hey, you know, it's 4 hours a week I could spend, you know, tweeting about myself, or 4 hours a week I could spend trying to get better. And so I chose the latter.
And is it good not to look at, to talk to someone but not look at them? I mean, in many ways, I guess you're talking to yourself.
You're talking to yourself, but you're also talking to your parents and to other important figures, but primarily your parents, because that's who you see as being mm-hmm. That's the projection, you know. And so you learn so much about your parents by thinking that they're sitting right behind you when they're really nowhere near you. Mm-hmm.
And do your parents like the fact that you have been in therapy?
I don't think so. And again, that goes back to the idea in Russia that, as we see in the story of my father, that psychiatry was used to punish dissidents. You know, it was a tool that was used to destroy people, not help people. So mm-hmm. that's the idea. And even today, I mean, Russia is a country that I think deeply needs more psychiatry on any level. I mean, if we could just jettison an army of, you know, social workers from Park Slope, Brooklyn into Moscow, things would be a lot better. We wouldn't be facing the kind of world we do in Russia right now.
And do you have an idea I've been in therapy myself, about knowing sort of when you're done?
Yes, and I think it's no coincidence that several things have happened that are coinciding with the end of psychotherapy, including the birth of my son, being able to do that, to participate in raising him, and also in publishing this memoir. I think all the stars are aligned for an exit from psychoanalysis.
So has your psychoanalyst read your memoir?
I think he's reading it now. And he knows it already, so. I think he finds the pictures very amusing.
Yeah, and there are a lot of pictures in it, including a picture of you on the front. You look like you're, what, 3-4 years old?
No, I'm one and a half.
Goodness. With a very mature face.
I know, I already had the face of a 41-year-old. Maybe even the hairline.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought you were older than that. But there you are sitting in oh my goodness. It's a Soviet, the drabbest little car.
It's a Soviet photo studio where they would pose you in the latest of Soviet technology, so things like a telephone or, you know, in this case, a very sad Volga car.
You look a little worried.
I'm worried, and I just learned how to drive this year, so, you know, most kids would grab the wheel of this car, but I'm kind of sitting with the hands folded, and I'm wearing my little sailor suit, in which all Russian boys are, until the age of 7, are forced to wear, so it's a strange little picture, but.
So why did it take you, 20 years to get your driver's license?
I had one all along, but I was just too scared to drive, you know.
Oh, really?
At one point, you know, I talk about with my mother about how when I was young, I was scared of the fan and scared of the ceiling and scared of the bathtub. And I said, why was I so scared of everything? And my mother says a very factual way, well, because you were born a Jewish person.
Oh, geez, really? Well, you write something about your parents. My parents don't spend money because disaster is right around the corner. You could also turn that on its head and say, you know, spend all the money you want because disaster is right around the corner.
Right, but their version is save because disaster's on the corner. We're going to lose our jobs. We don't speak English. Somebody at work hates us, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Let me get, it looks like Rich from New Jersey to join our conversation. And Rich, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty and Gary.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Maybe you were too young, but I'm curious whether you got any sense of political oppression in Russia. And are there any parallels between what went on there and what people are talking about with the surveillance state in the United States? And I, just real briefly, one of your previous books, Super Sad Love Story, which is one of my favorites.
Thank you.
You paint a picture of the United States 20 or 30 years down the road, which is very dystopian, but also some of the things in your book kind of look like what's going on today with privacy issues. So just curious in your comments between the parallels between Russia and the U.S. now.
Thanks, Rich. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, in some ways, the scarier part is that the United States, the NSA, is actually a lot better at monitoring. You know, the technology is so improved and everything is done through email right now that theoretically you could listen to everything. I mean, in the Soviet Union, yes, calls were monitored abroad and stuff like that, but there was a finite amount of phone operators you could have sitting and monitoring every conversation in Leningrad and Moscow and the rest of the 300 million plus people in the former Soviet Union. So what we have is in some ways a lot scarier. I mean, I don't think it'll be used in the same horrific purposes that you know the Soviet Union used it for, but the possibility is there, and that's not great. Personally, I didn't see very much oppression because I was a little kid, and little kids, even in today's Russia, are treated like little gods. I mean, first of all, most people have like one child or two children, so there's this kind of Chinese little emperor kind of thing going on in countries where you have only one child or two children. So, but my father, you know, he was very outspoken, and I think that cost him sometimes his jobs and stuff like that, and he would march in front of the synagogues with other protesters shouting, "We are Jews," and that was not something that you did if you wanted to get ahead or have a place in Soviet society. So he was very brave in that way.
Rich, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Are you religious in any way, in a Jewish kind of way?
I'm, you know, very much in love with Jewish culture and literature, but after 8 years of yeshiva, I think I paid my dues. I'm okay with that stuff. Thank you.
Well, I'm curious because you've written three novels. Now you've written a memoir. You've spent 12 years in psychoanalysis. Do you think that's going to change you as a writer?
Well, this book was, I think, is a change from the satirical kind of fiction that I've written before. I mean, I think this is a kind of break. What it also does is, because it reveals so much about me, is that it exhausts a lot of the material that has shaped previous fiction, so that now I have no choice but to sort of jump off the cliff and go in a different direction. Mm-hmm. The first interviewer that interviewed me after this book came out, Francine Prose, the wonderful writer, said, "Wow, after this book, I think I know you better than my husband of 20 years," which is, you know, means that I have to move on in a slightly different direction.
And are you comfortable putting you out there, as you certainly have in this memoir? I mean, yeah. You wrote it, but
I wrote it.
But nonetheless.
Look, I wrote it, and my feeling is if you're going to write a memoir, you have to put it all out there. You have to be as honest as you can. You can't glorify yourself. You can't glorify your parents, but you can't glorify yourself. I was a jerky little kid for a long time, and that is who I was. And it's not that you're proud or not proud of it. It's the truth, and that's what has to be on the page. Otherwise, don't write a memoir. Write something else.
Well, Gary Steingart, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us
today
on Radio Times. And his new book is a memoir. It is titled Little Failure. He's also the author of three novels, The Russian Debutante's Handbook, Absurdistan, and Super Sad True Love Story. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.